Welcome to Christchurch Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com.
My home is not on this earth, not in this world.
So when you think about the story of your life, if I was going to ask you to give me like the timeline of what's happened to you over your life, I bet along the way you could pick out a few days that you would say, these days are the big ones. These are the significant days in my story. So there'll be different things for different ones of you. For some of you, it might be days in your education. So maybe when you graduated from university, or when you got your A-levels, or maybe when you passed your driving test after failing like six times, but you finally cracked it. Maybe it's a big day in your career. It's the day that you got your first job, or the day you got like a breakthrough promotion into the field that you want to work in. Maybe it's a big day in a relationship. Maybe it's the day that you met someone who you went on to fall in love with. Maybe it's the day you first met your best friend. Maybe it's your wedding day. Different days are big days. Maybe it's the day that you bought your first house, and that's like a landmark moment for you. Maybe you pinpoint days in your spiritual journey. So the day you first became a Christian, the day you got baptized, the day you first were able to share your faith with somebody else. And these are the big days. And I think most of the days that we would call the big days, the significant ones, are big because something changed. It was one way before, but then something happened on this day. And from that day on, everything was different. It set us on a new course. Well, today we're going to be talking about a big day. And this isn't just big in terms of my life or your life, although it definitely impacts our lives. We're going to be talking about the biggest day, the most significant turning point in the history of the world. And that is the day that Jesus rose from the dead. And just to kind of set some context why this is so important, let me just ask you a couple of questions. So, have you ever wondered, like maybe on one of your worst days, have you ever wondered if your faith is actually real? If there's actually any substance to it? Like, you know, when you pray, have you ever asked the question, how do I know that these prayers aren't just hitting the ceiling? How do I know that this that I've believed is actually true? How do I know I've not made it up? Or how do I know that the person who told me this hasn't just made it up? Is there anything to it? Because most worldviews, ideas, philosophies seem like they're just kind of operating on a mental level. They're in your head, but that's the only place they are. Is there any way you can look besides in your own head to say Christianity is true? Some days when we have doubts in the faith, we need something that we can look at and say, oh, because of this, I know that everything that I'm doing, everything that I'm spending my life doing is actually worthwhile. Or I think about when I talk to people who aren't Christians, who don't know Jesus, and they'll often want to like talk about what I believe and why. And one of the questions that often they'll ask is like, look, are you open-minded? Are you willing to change your beliefs? Is there anything I could do that would change your beliefs? And I say, well, actually, there is. Because Christianity is quite unique in that it's historical. It's grounded on actual events that happened in history. And if you could show me that those events didn't happen, then everything would fall away. Okay? It is a historical thing. Jesus, when he was asked, what is the sign that all he was teaching and all he was doing, what's the sign that is true? He said, okay, I'll show you a sign that you can base all of this on. And he pointed to his body. He said, if you destroy this temple, in 3 days, I'll raise it up again. Okay? He said, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to suffer, I'm going to die, and on the third day, I will be raised from the dead. He staked everything on the fact that he would rise from the dead. So if it's true that Jesus rose from the dead, then that means that everything he ever said is also true. Everything he did is also significant. It means that when we're praying, it's not just hitting the ceiling. It means when we're doubting, our faith isn't just in our head. It is based on something tangible and on something substantial. On the other hand, if Jesus is still rotting in a grave in the Palestinian countryside, if his body is dead and not alive, then everything is false, is meaningless, isn't worthwhile. This is the thing that it all hangs on. It's the big one. So we're going to read from 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Now this is Paul, one of the early church leaders, writing to a church that he started, and then he'd moved away to go starting churches elsewhere. And he's writing to them about this day. And then we'll talk about what he says. But as we go, we'll also look at what do some other people say? What other suggestions do people make about the facts of that day and what happened? Are there other theories? What do we make of them? And we'll try and get some kind of expert opinions from different fields as well. But let's read the verses to start with. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 from verse 1. Now I would remind you, brothers, of the gospel I preached to you, which you received, in which you stand, and by which you are being saved, if you hold fast to the word I preached to you, unless you believed in vain. For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me. For I am the least of the apostles, unworthy to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God I am what I am, and his grace towards me was not in vain. On the contrary, I worked harder than any of them. Though it was not I, but the grace of God that is with me. Whether then it was I or they, so we preach, and so you believed. Let's just pick out a few things that we learn in these verses. And I want to start in verse 3 with what seems like the simplest point of all. It says that Christ died. Jesus died. So what he's saying, just by saying this, Jesus died, is he's pointing us to a particular historical individual. So this was Jesus. He was born in Bethlehem. He grew up in Nazareth. He was a son of Mary. He had brothers who he grew up with. It was 2,000 years ago. It was in Palestine. There's one individual that we are talking about. And pretty much every reputable historian will come with me so far. Okay, pretty much everyone who looks at history will say, look, there's such a stir that was caused from that part of the world around this individual at that time. He was there. Okay, he lived. He was a person. So we're not talking about some allegory, some myth, some fairy tale character. This is a guy who lived 2,000 years ago. And the statement that Paul's making is, he died. Which, again, sounds fairly simple as a statement to make. Everyone who has ever lived, certainly except the people who are like still around now, but everyone who ever lived from that time in history died, okay? Nobody has just like lived and then not died. He died. But some people say, hang on, I'm not so sure about that. Okay, so Jesus died on a cross. Okay, he was executed by the Romans. It was a judicial execution. They accused him of certain crimes, particularly the crimes of blasphemy, of making himself out to be God and setting himself up as a rival to Caesar and so on. He was executed. He died. Some people would say, maybe he didn't. Maybe he just, when he was on the cross, he passed out. He went into a coma. He fell asleep. He nodded off. And so they thought he was dead. They took him down. They put him in the tomb. And then like he woke up. Yeah, I'm awake now. He got out. He's like, Shazam, I'm back. Here we are. Some people say that's happened. That's called the swoon theory. Now, I'm not so sure that holds much water. Okay? Anyone here ever do history at school? Anyone learn about the Romans? What do you know about the Romans? What were they good at? They were good at killing people. Okay, this was like their specialist subject. The Romans were experts at killing people. Crucifixion was the most efficient, brutal way of killing people in a painful way that they could think of. They wanted to punish people. They wanted people to suffer. They wanted people to be put to shame. They wanted the physical side of it to be as excruciating, literally means from the cross. That's how they wanted to be. Here's how it works, right? They start by whipping you. The prongs of the whip dug into your back. They tore out flesh. They tore off skin. So you were red raw. Your back was completely open. Then they give you the rough wooden crossbeam and they make you drag it up the hill. Now, the wounds are open on your back. You've got this rough wood pressing against them as you're dragging it up the hill. Can you imagine the pain already? When you get to the top, they put physical nails through your hands, physical nails through your feet, and you're held up in place and you can't breathe. And the only way you can get a breath is to push yourself upwards. But what are you pushing against? The only things that are holding you there are the nails in your arms and your feet. And so you have to push for every breath. And every breath is a fight until eventually you don't have the fight left in you and you die of suffocation. That's how crucifixion was. It is brutal. And I can't imagine anyone being put in that situation and just nodding off, just passing out, but not dying. The Romans waited, and just to make sure, these executioners, before they took him off the cross, just to make sure he's really dead, they got a spear and they thrust it through his heart. So Jesus really died. Now this team of Roman executioners, it was their job. They did this over and over again. If they mistakenly took someone down who'd been sentenced to death and said, okay, you can go, but you're not dead, these guys would have lost their lives. Okay, they would have been executed for it. So Jesus really died. Here's what a 19th century scholar called David Friedrich Strauss, he was a skeptic, so he didn't believe in the resurrection. But on this theory, he just thought it was nonsense. He said, it's impossible that a being who had stolen half dead out of the sepulchre, who crept about weak and ill, wanting medical treatment, who required bandaging, strengthening and indulgence, and who still at last yielded to his sufferings, could have given his disciples the impression that he was a conqueror over death and the grave, the Prince of Life, an impression which lay at the bottom of their future ministry. Such a resuscitation could only have weakened the impression which he made upon them in life and death. At the most, could only have given it an elegiac voice, but could by no possibility have changed their sorrow into enthusiasm, have elevated their reverence into worship. What he said is, look, even if that happened, even if Jesus did just pass out and was in this like half mangled, half dead state, he's not going to walk out of the tomb and convince them that he's conquered death. He's going to be like a walking mess, isn't he? That's what this guy said. So first point that I think is the first step on our journey that Paul has taken us on. Jesus really died. Okay, that's what we need to see first. Well, then in verse 4, we get the next detail, and that's that Jesus was buried. Now, this might seem like a little pointless detail, but it's not. This is important in the story, because by saying Jesus was buried, Paul is inviting us to keep our eyes on the body. Okay, there's a physical body that went into a physical tomb, and he's saying, watch this space. See what happens to the body, because this is going to be really important along the way. You get some people who say, yeah, Jesus, the resurrection, I can go along with that. He lived on in spirit, didn't he? He lived on in the lives that he influenced. He lived on in the things that he taught to his followers. And what Paul's saying is we're talking about more than just living on in memory. We're talking about more than just a spiritual resurrection. I mean, think about it, right? You've got the early disciples. They're in Jerusalem and they're preaching and they're on the streets and they're saying to everyone, look, God has raised Jesus from the dead. You lot, you're guilty. You killed him. And God has reversed that. And now he's appointed Jesus to the highest place. And he's shown it by raising him from the dead. The authorities didn't like that message. There were some people in charge, and this was subversive, and they were being put out by it. And they tried everything to stop these guys preaching. Okay? They tried to intimidate them. They tried to persecute them. They tried to chase them out of town. But if Jesus wasn't physically raised, if it was just a spiritual thing, wouldn't they have just gone and got the body? And you've got all these guys saying, Jesus is risen from the dead. And they'd pull out the body and say, no, he isn't. Look, he's still dead. They would have had everything they needed to shut down early Christianity if we weren't talking about something physical. But they couldn't do it because the body was no longer in the tomb. So what we know is that Jesus really died, and then his body was laid in the tomb. And then 3 days later, it wasn't there. The tomb was empty. That's the next step that we need to be established. So Dr. Paul Mayer, he's a historian who specializes in ancient history. He said, where did Christianity first begin? Only one spot on earth, the city of Jerusalem. But this is the very last place it would have started if Jesus' tomb had remained occupied. Since anyone producing a dead Jesus would have driven a sodden stake through the heart of an incipient or beginning Christianity inflamed by a supposed resurrection. So Jesus really died, he was buried, then the tomb was empty. Verse 5 then starts to talk about the eyewitnesses. So it says, and that he appeared to Cephas. Now, that's like the Greek version of the name Peter. So Peter was one of Jesus' key disciples. And then to the 12. So appearing to Peter and to the 12. Now, here's the thing that some people say, because I've taken you on a bit of a journey so far. He died, he was buried, and then the tomb was empty. So, well, I can explain that one. I've got an idea how a tomb could be empty. Maybe someone took the body out of the tomb. That's kind of a common comeback that I hear. Let's just push into that one then. So who would have done it? I think there are three options you might answer that with. So one of them, you might say it was the disciples themselves that did it. Okay, we're just going to pause on that one. I'll talk about that one more in a few minutes. The other two options are, could it have been the authorities? Could the Roman authorities or the Jewish authorities at the time have for some reason taken the body out of the grave? But I'd ask you this question, why? Why would they have done that? What was their motive? They wanted to shut down the preaching of the resurrection. They wanted the body to be available for people to see. Why would they have removed it? It went against their interests. Or you might say, well, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just common grave robbers. Maybe it was just some chancers going in there, taking the body. Maybe they were looking for valuables in there or whatever it might be. How? How would they have done it? Because Jesus had said he was going to raise from the dead. The authorities had put guards at the tomb, so nobody could do that. They didn't want anyone get into the body to take it. There were these guards there. Are you telling me that some grave robbers would have really tried to take on Roman soldiers, bust into the grave, nick the body, and that the soldiers wouldn't have said anything about it? It doesn't add up that it was stolen by grave robbers or by the authorities. But also, this verse gives us the biggest comeback you might want against saying it was taken. Because if the body was nicked, why is Jesus appearing to his disciples? Well, why are the 12 seeing him alive? If grave robbers have taken it, who's appearing to Peter? Who's appearing to the 12? We've got two different things that now are Exhibit A and Exhibit B. Okay, you've got an empty tomb and you've got some resurrection appearances. Ask yourself this, why would good guys like Peter and John, these were salt of the earth guys, they were fishermen, they were religious guys, they were followers of a religious teacher, of a rabbi, why would they just make this up? Why would they go around and say, oh yeah, we've seen him alive, if they hadn't? And then answer me this, why would they suffer for it? Why would they die? Why would when the Romans had taken them and said, look, we will kill you, we will crucify you upside down, Peter, if you keep on proclaiming this? Why would they say, no, he is alive, do what you have to do? Surely, no one would die for something that they knew was false. No one would do that, would they? I wouldn't, you wouldn't. I'd like to think that maybe I'd have the courage to die for what I knew to be true. There's no way I'd die for something that I knew was made up. It would be ridiculous to do so. But these guys had seen it. Here's what Peter said. He said, we did not follow cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty. He's saying we saw it for ourselves. Or John, another of those disciples. He said, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we've seen with our own eyes, which we've looked upon and have touched with our hands concerning the word of life. One of the guys who was around at the time, a contemporary of this age, was Josephus. He was a Jewish Roman historian who was contemporary to all this. And he affirmed that these guys were really telling everyone they'd seen Jesus alive. He said, at this time, there was a wise man who was called Jesus. Pilate condemned him to be condemned and to die. And those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders. So we've got a few witnesses, okay? But you might be saying, okay, it's all well and good to have like a few of his close friends saying they've seen him alive. Have you got any more witnesses? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, we have. Verse 6, then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. 500 people saw him all at the same time. I mean, that's incredible. I don't know if any of you have ever seen a court case. I've seen plenty on TV. I've never actually been to one live. But usually they don't have 500 witnesses. They have a handful. They have a select few. I did some maths, right? Okay, maths is kind of my thing. I love to geek out on this stuff. Imagine we were doing a court case right now. And imagine I wanted to get my 500 witnesses. And I was going to get them one by one. And I was going to bring them up to the front. Now, we need to swear them in. They need to say their kind of oath that they're going to tell the truth. And then if I was just to ask them one question, did you see Jesus alive? And they were just to answer, yes, I did. And then they were to leave. How long do you reckon that would take? Maybe a minute per person, let's say? If we started now with our first witness, by the time the 500th one was done with, it'd be 3 a.m. Okay? That's a lot of witnesses, isn't it? That is just a bulk of testimony. But just see what he said. He said, most of whom are still alive, although some have fallen asleep. Now, obviously this was written 2,000 years ago, so they're not still alive now. Okay? But at the time, the way he's writing it has the tone of, look, most of these guys are around. You don't need to take my word for it. Go and ask them. These people are available. They're there. Just go and chat with them about what they saw, and they will tell you. He's saying this was a very public event to which many, many people are testifying. So here's another one that some people sometimes say. This is a fun one when people try to argue this. They say, you know those guys who said they saw Jesus alive? They were hallucinating. It was kind of in their minds because, you know, they suffered a lot of trauma, hadn't they? Their good friend, their leader had died. Placed under that level of stress, wouldn't you start imagining things as well? Now, let's just put to one side the fact that there's an empty tomb that doesn't account for. 500 people saw him all at the same time. Now, I don't know if you've ever had a hallucination, but you don't share them with other people, do you? A hallucination, it's not how they work. It would be an individual thing that you're seeing that no one else around you can see. But for 500 people, all at the same time, to see him, well, that is something else. Here's what Gary Collins, a doctor of psychology, said. Hallucinations are individual occurrences. By their very nature, only one person can see a given hallucination at a time. They certainly aren't something which can be seen by a group of people. Neither is it possible that one person is able to somehow induce a hallucination in somebody else. Since a hallucination exists only in the subjective personal sense, it is obvious that others cannot witness it. So what else have we got? We've got our first witnesses, which were Peter and the 12. Now we've got this crowd of 500 people. Maybe they're all sympathetic. Maybe they were all kind of on board with Jesus before. Do we have any more hostile witnesses? Do we have anyone who was a bit more sceptical? And again, verse 7 and 8 shows us that we do. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me. So we've got two characters introduced here. Firstly, there's James. Now, James was a brother of Jesus. They grew up in the same house. They sat at the same table. They ate the same cornflakes. They played together after school. And he knew Jesus very well. But what's interesting is when Jesus was out and about, when he was teaching, when he was doing miracles, did James follow him? No. I mean, imagine, kind of, I don't know how many of you have got siblings, right? Imagine you've grown up with your siblings, and then at the age of 30, one of them starts going around, like, teaching like they're some kind of big shot, like they know it all, and they start, like, doing, like, magic tricks, and healing the sick, and calming storms, and getting a bit of a reputation. What would you say? How would you feel if your brother or sister started doing that? Maybe you'd feel a bit like James. It says in John's Gospel, not even his brothers believed in him. In fact, we see one time Jesus was trying to go to this festival to teach, and his brothers are like, no, Jesus, stay at home. Just like, don't go there. It's like you'll embarrass the family. That's probably what I'd do if my sibling was out doing this stuff. I just want to keep a lid on it and not have the shame of them being out there. And James didn't believe. Now let me ask you this question, right, those of you with siblings. What would it take for you to start worshipping your brother or sister? What would it take for you to describe yourself just as a servant of theirs, to give your whole life to proclaiming their praise and glory and persuading everyone else to do it? I don't think many of us would do that for our siblings, would we? Again, it's not something I would be inclined to do. But you see the change in James from the guy who was embarrassed, who was skeptical, who thought Jesus was bringing shame on the family, to a guy who would give his all to proclaim Jesus is Lord. What would change that? Maybe something like a resurrection. Seeing him die, a I come back alive again. It's like, wow, maybe he was right all along. And the second character we saw in verse 8 was Paul himself, the guy who was writing this letter. Now, Paul's backstory is an interesting one, because he was a devout Pharisee. Now, a Pharisee was one of the religious groupings of the day. He was brought up at the feet of a guy called Gamaliel, who was one of the leaders in the council. He knew his stuff, his Old Testament scriptures. He was an expert, and he was zealous, and he was passionate for the law and for obedience. And he saw Christians as heretics. He saw Christians as basically people who'd gone away from the way of God, and he wanted to eradicate them, and he used violent means to do so. Okay? He was a violent man. He would search out to arrest and to kill the early Christians. That's what he was about. You could compare him perhaps to, I don't know if you saw a few years ago, on the news, the ISIS guys who got Christians on the beach and started beheading them. That was the kind of extremes that Paul was willing to go to against Christians. And yet here he is now, as a leader in the early church, as a guy who, as a guy who is giving his life and who actually literally died for the gospel. What would take that turnaround? What would take someone who was so opposed to wiping out Christianity to become its greatest champion? Well, as Paul tells the story, he was on the way to Damascus to find more Christians to persecute. And there he was stopped, and Jesus, the risen Lord, appeared to him and showed himself and showed that it was all true. It would take something like a resurrection. You know, one of the explanations people try and give is that this whole thing was a con, that they made it up, that they were just trying to carry on this movement that would otherwise have died, so they did whatever it took. I've got a few questions about that. Firstly, how did they pull it off? Okay, if the tomb was guarded, how did they bust in there and get the body out? And how did they do so without anyone noticing and without a big fuss about it? And it doesn't really explain, if it's a con, how thousands of people, just in those first few days, were just brought to life by the Holy Spirit and just joined this movement and saw that God was in it. It doesn't explain why these guys were willing to die for it. It doesn't explain why they'd suffer, why their lives, why they'd endure harsh circumstances, endure shipwrecks, endure beatings in public, go from place to place as strangers and aliens in the world. So it doesn't explain James and the turnaround in him. It doesn't explain Paul and the huge turnaround in his life. It doesn't work. It doesn't explain why all these people somehow had changed course and were on this track to say, Jesus is alive and I'm giving my life for it. Can't be a con. We know a few things. We know that Jesus really died. We know that he was buried. And we know that 3 days later, his tomb really was empty. We know that many people over the next few weeks, including skeptics and opponents of his, saw him alive. They're the facts. Now we need to figure out how we're going to explain them. Saying he didn't really die won't do it. We've talked about that. We've seen that that's impossible. Saying it was just a spiritual resurrection that we're talking about, that just won't do it. We've looked at that. We've seen that that's impossible. Saying that thieves took the body, that won't do it. We've looked at that. We've seen that that's impossible. Saying it was just hallucinations, that won't do it. We've looked at that. We've seen that that's impossible. Saying it was all a fabrication, that won't do it. We've looked at that and we've seen that that's impossible. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the writer of the Sherlock Holmes stories, had this famous quote. He said, "When you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. And there is only one explanation that remains that can account for all the facts that we've seen. And that is that Jesus is alive. He really did rise from the dead, like he said. He said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up again. And he did. He said, I'll go to Jerusalem, I'll suffer, and I'll die. But on the third day I'll rise again. And he did. That's the only explanation that makes sense. So let me finish by telling you three reasons this matters. And then next time in the rest of 1 Corinthians, we'll look more at why it matters. But just three for today. Number one is that it means that death has lost. And that is incredible news. Because life doesn't always seem like that, does it? Sometimes it seems like death is winning. You know, when loved ones, when people close to us pass away, it seems like this world is in the grip of death. when we struggle with sickness, when our bodies start to creak and break, and when those around us get sick, it seems like death is winning. And yet here, in the middle of history, all of a sudden, there's a knockout blow to death itself. Here's someone who it can't keep down, which shows it's not the most powerful thing out there. And this resurrection of Jesus, it's like an announcement pregnant with promise, because it's saying to death, you have lost. You will not win. You will not keep this world in your grips forever. And we know that Jesus is going to return. All in him will be raised. The whole creation will be renewed in the glory of eternal life. Life has won and death has lost. That encourages me when I have aches and pains. That encourages me when I have relatives in hospital sick. That encourages me when those around me pass away, because I know that this isn't how it will be forever. Death has lost. Here's the second thing that it shows us. It shows us that everything is possible. Everything is possible. Do you ever feel like circumstances can defeat you? That you have things going on in your life that you just can't handle, that there is no escape from, that will keep you in their grips forever? And yet here we see that the biggest enemy, the ultimate thing, was beaten, that Jesus has power even over death itself. So whatever is going on in our lives, this same power that raised Christ from the dead, well, this power can be at work in the things that go on in our lives. This morning, I was chatting with a guy this morning at one of our other sites. He was saying a week ago he was in a really tough bind financially. He was struggling. He couldn't make ends meet, and he asked someone to pray for him. And the next day, a check came through his letterbox for $3,000. I mean, that's incredible, isn't it? But what happened there? This same power that raised Jesus from the dead, is that power really unable to cope with a bit of financial trouble? No, the same power was able to help him in that circumstance. And in Ephesians, it says the same power that raised Christ from the dead is now at work in us, in our lives. God's power by his Holy Spirit is at work. So death has lost, everything is possible. And here's our third implication, and it's kind of a simple one. You've probably guessed it by now, but Jesus is alive. You know, if Jesus was raised from the dead, that means he is alive. And a few weeks after his resurrection, after he'd appeared to all these witnesses, he ascended to heaven to take the seat at the right hand of God, where he rules and reigns over all things. But because Jesus is alive, that means you and I can know him today. That as we gather, as we sing, as we have community with each other, and actually throughout the week as well, we can be in his presence. We can talk to him and hear from him. We can enjoy being with him. You can know Jesus today. You know, as you turn from your sin and embrace him as Savior and risen Lord, if you accept Jesus, you will have a relationship with him, the Messiah, the risen one, the King. He can be in your life today. That's a decision that I made about 16 years ago, and I have not looked back. It's the best thing that I've ever done. So I would encourage you, give yourself to Jesus today. He is alive and he is here.